From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Detroit Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick and his former chief of staff Christine Beattie are being arraigned today. Charges include perjury, obstruction of justice, and other federal crimes. The pair turned themselves in yesterday afternoon. The two sent each other racy text messages on city-issued cell phones. Then they denied their alleged romance under oath in a whistleblower lawsuit. That settlement cost taxpayers $8.4 million. The Detroit City Council and others are calling for Kilpatrick's resignation. If Kilpatrick is convicted, a city charter would force him out of office. Still, he says he won't resign and he'll fight the charges in court. As Detroit digs deeper into the scandal, how is the city and its community reacting? In just a few minutes, we'll talk to a community leader there. But joining me first is M.L. Elric of the Detroit Free Press. He's one of the two reporters who uncovered the documents with the racy text messages. Thanks for coming on.
My pleasure, Farai.
So the mayor's being arraigned today. What's next for him in legal terms?
Well, after he's arraigned, he'll probably be required to post a bond. I expect they'll let him go on personal recognizance, and then they'll schedule a preliminary examination. That's a procedure where the prosecutor will go and provide some evidence. They won't put on the whole case, but they'll show a judge what they expect to put on at a trial if it goes that far. And the purpose there is they need to convince the judge that they have enough evidence to basically inconvenience this man with a trial. Judges typically do go through these preliminary examinations and say there's something here for a jury to decide, in which case the man would be bound over for trial, and then we'd get through the whole pretrial motions, jury selection, and all that, which will send him right on his way into the criminal justice system.
You've watched this story unfold. You've helped unpack this story. How have citizens' attitudes about the mayor changed since he took office?
Well, my partner Jim Schaefer and I have been exposing wrongdoing by the mayor for years. Misuse of the city credit card, elaborate spending on this petty cash fund, trips, things like that. But people didn't like it, but for the most part they tolerated it. Now I think they've had enough. The mayor ran for re-election in 2005. His first campaign commercial asked for people to forgive him. He apologized. Totally unprecedented and a very difficult decision for him to make. I think people were willing to give him a break, were willing to say that this is a young man who's going to make mistakes and is going to grow. But I think what they've decided now is that he's not growing and he's got to be going.
Now, how does his behavior compare to other Detroit politicians and mayors? This is not exactly unprecedented, unfortunately.
Well, you know, in Detroit, we've had a lot of controversy with our Mayor Coleman Young, who was in office for a long time. There were lots of investigations. Nothing ever came of them. The previous mayor, Dennis Sartre, had 8 fairly uneventful years. But with Kilpatrick, it's been, as he put it himself in his State of the City address, a roller coaster ride. This mayor is the first one in Detroit's history to ever be charged with a crime while in office. You're talking about a 300-year history. So this is, you know, Halley's Comet comes by more often than this happens. But we've had mayors in the past who have had trouble, who have been investigated, but nothing compares to what we're going through right now.
You mentioned that the mayor, you know, is a young man. I mean, 38 years old is young for the mayor of a major city. And people have wanted to give him slack. But at this point, has the tide turned and have people just said, you know what, we're done? Is this also hurting the morale of the city?
Well, you know, Detroit feels like it's on an upswing right now. We've got a lot of good things going on in the city, from our sports team to developments downtown. And we have a national reputation. It's hard to get past that. And frankly, one of the concerns Detroiters have is, are people going to see Detroit in the same light as they see the mayor? And right now, I think there's a general feeling in Detroit that we do not want to be dragged down as we're surging with everything that's going on around this mayor.
Now, if convicted, Kilpatrick would be expelled from office and could face up to 15 years in prison. To the extent that you have a sense of it, does it seem as if the punishments could get that harsh?
Well, it seems unlikely that he would serve 15 years in prison, but the prosecutor told the Free Press yesterday in an exclusive interview that we have on Freep.com that she will not be satisfied if he resigns. He basically can't pull a Spitzer, I guess you'd say.
And avoid prosecution by stepping down.
That's right.
Now, the text messages that Kilpatrick and Beattie exchanged could be a key, you know, note for the prosecution. Kilpatrick's attorney has already said he'll try to keep the text from being introduced as evidence. Do you think really that that is possible?
Well, there's some discussion as to whether or not these text messages are admissible. Clearly, the prosecutor feels that they are. We've had judges rule that they can be delivered by subpoena, so they don't seem to see a problem with it. And just politically, one of the problems the mayor is going to have is that he doesn't seem to be denying that they're accurate. He just seems to be trying to take them out of the mix. In other words, if I can't win on the evidence, let's get rid of the evidence.
All right, ML, thanks so much.
It's my pleasure.
ML Elric is a reporter for the Detroit Free Press. He joined us by phone from the 36th District Courthouse in downtown Detroit. Now we turn to Bertram Marks to talk about how the scandal is affecting the Detroit community. He's an attorney for the Council of Baptist Pastors for Detroit and Vicinity. Thanks for coming on.
It's my pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Let me start out by noting that someone gave me a call. One of our listeners from Detroit gave me a call and said that he thought that on our show, as in many other venues, that this mayor was not getting a fair shake. Are there a lot of people who believe that this is an unwanted prosecution or persecution of the mayor?
I couldn't say that a lot of people believe that. And let me just say this. What I know about the local affiliate here, if I can call it that, this is probably one of the most balanced and fair forums that you're going to get. And so I think it's a bit disingenuous to suggest that somehow the press has created the mess we're in right now. I just don't get that from a majority of the people that are talking to the pastors that I represent. I think the feeling is probably better expressed in terms of frustration, in terms of disbelief. There is a willingness to be forgiving. But there's also this notion of accountability. And often when people turn to the faith community, they say, even politicians will often say, well, you're supposed to be forgiving. Yes, the faith community is forgiving, but there's also accountability that is attached to forgiveness. And I think that's where most of the people that we're talking to are expressing. That seems to be their general sentiment. Nobody wants to see this mayor, his family, this city, suffer through this devastating situation. We're hoping that it can be resolved quickly.
When you think about politics today, there's been a spate of people having to face sexual revelations, Spitzer and Patterson in New York, Kilpatrick. But this is not the legal prosecution is not about sex. It's about, you know, lying under oath and questions like that. Nonetheless, you know, as someone who works in the faith community, is sex what's making people pay attention to this, or is it these larger issues of corporate and city governance and propriety? I mean, how are people relating to this, do you think?
There's where we're getting some mixed views. Some people do believe this is a situation that simply involves the mayor and his wife. I don't believe that average citizens have educated themselves on the issues, the deeper issues, the issues that affect his oath of office, the issues that affect his fiduciary responsibility as it relates to being the mayor. I don't think people are looking at the actions that were taken relative to the police officers who were discharged and why they were discharged. If people would look at those issues, I think they'd probably formulate different opinions. But it would be disingenuous for me not to say that absolutely. We have heard from some of our constituents that, you know, this is a private affair of the mayor's. Why is the press digging into this? These sexual revelations, this would be a non-issue.
Do you believe that the prosecutor, Wayne County Prosecutor Kim Worthy, is taking on the establishment by pursuing this case?
I don't. What I know about Kim Worthy is that she's a very fair-minded individual, and she's also a very focused individual. I don't think that any of the ramifications of these charges, one way or the other, have influenced what she decided to do. I think she looked at the situation, made an informed judgment, and determined that she had to bring charges. I just don't view her as sort of taking on the establishment. Now, the effect of what she's done is going to reverberate through the establishment. I think that she's ushering in a new era in Detroit politics, one which says that, you know, you got to place a very high value on integrity and on transparency and on being open and honest when communicating with the city. And my hope, my prayer is that the mayor, no matter what happens in this situation, and not just the mayor, but politicians who are coming forward, politicians who are sitting now, get that message that integrity does mean something and honesty is the best policy.
What role, if any, does the faith community have in making sure that as these things unfold, people are in a position to advocate for themselves as citizens and make good decisions?
I think the role of the faith community is critical. And if you look at the faith community's role throughout history, it should be to be a prophetic voice, to be a voice for the voiceless, those who are marginalized, those who seek direction. They should be able to turn to the faith community to find that direction. We are to minimize anger, polarization, anything that seeks to diminish our relationship with one another as human beings. We should be trying to somehow mitigate that. We also have to be willing to speak truth to power, no matter what the situation, no matter what the scenario. What I can say about the Council of Baptist Pastors of Detroit and vicinity is that we have very, very good leadership. I'm very proud of Dr. Oscar King, our president, who has been very deliberate, who has sought to get information, who has continually and consistently sought to gather information so that he can make an informed decision about what he should say and when he should say it to the mayor. He has not been driven by the spotlight. He has not been driven by pressures, both political and public. He has been very deliberate about making an informed decision, and I commend him for that.
All right. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Bertram Marks is an attorney for the Council of Baptist Pastors for Detroit and Vicinity. He joined us from the studios of the NPR member station WDET in Detroit. And next, we have Africa Update. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. It's time now for our Africa update and a critical election coming up in Zimbabwe. Robert Mugabe has led the country for 28 years, since the end of Zimbabwe's war for independence. He was once seen as the Mandela of Zimbabwe, a liberator. Now many inside and outside the country see him as a dictator. Still, this weekend, Zimbabweans will get to vote for Mugabe and his ZANU-PF party, or for a popular politician who left ZANU-PF to run on his own, or for an opposition party, the Movement for Democratic Change. The stakes are high, and many citizens have concerns about voter intimidation and fraud. For more, we've got Violet Gonda. She's a Zimbabwean journalist with SW Radio Africa, an independent station which broadcasts from London into Zimbabwe. She's currently on a night fellowship at Stanford University. Violet, welcome.
Hi, Farai, and thank you for having me on the program.
Let's back up a little bit into the history of Zimbabwe. In 1980, it became one of the last African nations to shed its colonial government. And when Robert Mugabe came to power, he was, among other things, open to white farmers and other whites staying in Zimbabwe. Over the years, he redistributed the land, and a lot of people see the current economic collapse as a result of this land ownership change. But what other factors played into Zimbabwe going from where it was in 1980 to where it is today?
When Mugabe authorized the violent takeover of land, he basically directly affected millions of people. And then also the other issue were Mugabe's economic policies. For example, a bloated or rather large government meant that not only did the economy suffer when he took over the farms, but we also had a government that was living far, far, far beyond, you know, its means. Also, the economic policies churned out by the regime were not in the best interest of the majority of the people, but the best interest of the ruling party. And a good example, you know, is the indigenization policy, where economic wealth was supposed to be distributed to the majority, you know, from white minority rule. But all you had was this transfer of power from the white elite and only to a black elite, and nothing much really was done to empower the masses. And then also the government blames the West for creating the problems, you know, the usual colonialist destroying our country and the sanctions. And perhaps, you know, the Western withdrawal of financial aid to the Mugabe regime exacerbated what was already happening.
Let's go directly to the election. The three sort of pillars of this stool are Mugabe himself, mm-hmm. Simba Mokone, and then the Movement for Democratic Change, one wing of that. Yes. Explain who those players are and what they represent to different constituencies, and who have you spoken to among them?
Well, I haven't been able to speak to Robert Mugabe. It's very difficult for an independent journalist, but I have been able to interview Dr. Simba Mokone and Mr. Morgan Tsvangirai. Dr. Simba Mokone, himself a former cabinet minister in Mugabe's government, and he actually broke away from the ruling party just last month. He's standing as an independent, and it's still difficult for me to say what he stands for, as he was very evasive and would not answer simple questions, especially to do with social justice issues, which is a real big problem in Zimbabwe. But it is widely believed, because of his education and because he was seen as a moderate in ZANU-PF, he may be able to bring about the economic reforms that are necessary to resuscitate the collapsing Zimbabwean economy right now. The other presidential candidate is opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai, who, as I mentioned, that, you know, he stands for economic reforms like Simba Mokone. But Tsvangirai has come out and said he also stands out for political freedoms. Unfortunately, though, he has spent the last 8 years trying to survive the brutality of the Mugabe regime. So it's also hard to really say what he stands exactly for, because most of the time he's spending time defending himself and being arrested. And the regime has also infiltrated his party, thereby weakening it significantly. Where people want quick fix solutions, they want Mugabe out, and, you know, if you were to put a baboon against Mugabe, I'm sure people would rather vote for this baboon.
So, Violet, Zimbabwe has been in economic freefall recently. They're, you know, a loaf of bread, from what I understand, now is 10 million Zim dollars. When you talk to people back in Zimbabwe, what kind of stories have you heard of how people are making choices to survive?
Survival is the most, you know, important thing in Zimbabwe right now. You know, in just under 8 years, Zimbabwe has gone from being the breadbasket of Southern Africa to a basket case. And, you know, you can imagine with inflation at 150,000%, it's very difficult for the ordinary person to survive. I know of a certified accountant who has opted to sell, you know, wares on the streets rather than to engage in formal employment, because spending 8 hours on a job in an office in Zimbabwe these days means nothing, you know, for many. Doctors, nurses, teachers are constantly on strike for better wages, and educated people are being forced to leave the country or adopt a subsistence lifestyle.
Who is going to get to decide if the people of Zimbabwe have had their say? Do you anticipate, in other words, that coming up there will be some conflict over the election results, no matter what they are? Or do people, from what you've heard and people you've talked to, seem willing to accept the results that come back?
That is a difficult one. We've had army commanders declaring that they will not support and salute anyone other than the current president. And, you know, the ultimate fear is to return back, if, you know, to the situation during the liberation struggle, where the people in places like the rural areas especially suffered the most. So it's very difficult. The levels of desperation among, you know, the common Zimbabweans are high, and people want change. And therefore, I fear that the revolutionary threshold is at its peak right now in Zimbabwe. You know, once that vote is stolen this weekend, I fear that something else will take place. But the difference is that, you know, the target of this is going to be purely political, as compared to what we've seen in Kenya, for example. We're probably going to see something like people against the regime or the regime against the people, unlike, you know, along ethnic lines as we have been seeing happening in East Africa, in Kenya. So it's a difficult and worrying time in Zimbabwe right now.
Violet, thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Farai.
Violet Gonda is a Zimbabwean journalist with SW Radio Africa. She's currently on a night fellowship at Stanford University. And now for more on the Zimbabwean elections and a larger look at political elections in Africa, we've got Professor Edmund Keller. He's the director of the Globalization Research Center on Africa at the University of California, Los Angeles. Welcome back.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So you just heard Violet talk about how Zimbabweans are feeling about this election. Robert Mugabe has been in power for almost three decades. What are the actual rules for this election?
Well, actually, right now, there are going to be four different electoral contests, one for the presidency, one for the parliament, and one for the Senate. And then there will be some local elections, and voters will have to vote in each one of those. And for the presidency, a candidate can be elected on the first round if he gets 51% of the vote. If no candidate gets 51% of the vote within 3 weeks, there has to be a runoff involving the top two contestants.
There's already a debate going on about whether or not this is a fair election, and it hasn't even happened yet. The International Crisis Group issued a report saying the elections are already, quote, flawed by pre-poll misbehavior by the government. And then you also have the opposition party, the Movement for Democratic Change, saying that the government has printed 3 million excess ballots, which could be used for ballot box stuffing. What are the chances that this will be a free and fair election?
Well, from all I can tell, it doesn't seem like this will be a free and fair election. Although Mugabe has structured things prior to the election, non-electoral kinds of things, so that he might easily win with the popular vote. For example, he introduced this Indigenization and Economic Empowerment Act, which is supposed to guarantee that every foreign-owned company and multinational corporation operating in Zimbabwe has at least 51% of its assets controlled by indigenous Zimbabweans. He has also raised the salaries of public officials, bureaucrats, military officials, teachers, all in an effort to get a favorable outcome from those groups. And, of course, you know, you've heard about the electoral problems. For example, it's estimated that there are not enough polling places in the capital city, and this would be the stronghold of the opposition. And each individual will have somewhere in the neighborhood of 12 minutes to vote in all four elections that I mentioned. By contrast, in Mashonaland, where Mugabe is strong, there are enough polling places, and folks will have a much more extended period of time in which to cast their own personal vote.
It's interesting. It reminds me of the last U.S. presidential election where there were some allegations that in Ohio in particular, the urban areas had overcrowded, long waits, long lines, and then the suburban areas had more polling places. So in some ways, these questions of fairness, they arise in the worst of circumstances and then in much better circumstances. But on that note, let's broaden this a little bit to talk about elections in Africa. How many African nations or what portion of African nations seem to have an electoral process that is stable and that works for the citizens versus other ones that are either dictatorships or where elections are unpredictable, not free and not fair?
There are not many military dictatorships in Africa as opposed to 20 years ago. There are multi-party systems throughout the continent, but we have to remember that elections do not necessarily equal democracy. But there have been, you know, I think that, you know, the places where there have been successful turnovers of incumbent regimes under a multi-party system are not given enough credit. There are many more than there are not. The violence we saw in Kenya was unexpected. Kenya had had a smooth transition from the rule of Daniel Arap Moi to the rule of Mwai Kibaki. And it could very well have turned out that way, too, if it wasn't for some electoral rigging and planning on the part of the two different camps to destabilize the country after these elections. Ghana's had a smooth transition 8 years ago, and it's going to have another election pretty soon, and it's expected that that will be a free and fair election. Benin is a good place to think about, Madagascar, Mauritius. So I think that, you know, it's important to realize that even though it looks like Africans always at each other's throats surrounding elections, it's not as dire as we might think.
You mentioned that you believe that elections don't equal democracy. How do you distinguish the two of those?
Well, you know, elections are procedures that we find in democracies. But, you know, there has to be a culture of democracy. If you had a free and fair election, there wouldn't be rigging. There wouldn't be ballot stuffing and intimidation. So democracy has more components than just elections.
Tell me about what you call the two turnover test and how it relates to elections in Africa.
Well, that's a term that's been coined by American political scientists, and it relates to the fact that once you have the move away from single-party systems to multi-party systems, and even if the incumbent in the single-party system became a contestant in the two-party system or multi-party system, there would be now term limits as opposed to in the past. So let's say, for example, Jerry Rawlings introduced multi-party democracy in Ghana. He stood for two terms. He won in both of those terms. But now he's been succeeded by this businessman, John Kufuor. If these elections come off without a hitch, well, then we'll be seeing that transitions have been orderly. And if Kufuor is thrown out, of course, or his successor is thrown out, then that would be further sign of the consolidation and deepening of democracy. So that's basically what that essentially means.
Do you think that international observers are going to be watching Zimbabwe closely, assuming, if so, that they'll mainly be outside of the country?
Yes, they will mainly be outside of the country. The ones that will definitely be inside are representatives of the African Union, as well as the representatives of the South African Development Community. It's said that observers from Iran, from China, from Russia, and maybe even North Korea will also be there, but no EU or United States representation.
I'm seeing a trend. It's former Soviet Union, Cold War affiliated, and that gets into the whole complex history of the Cold War in Africa. But you can tell that it's kind of like there's like an ideological line, and it's if you're on this one side, you can come in, and if you're on the other side, you can't.
Yeah, exactly. The case of China is interesting because China makes it a practice in its Africa policy to claim non-interference in a country's politics, and that makes it favored in places like Sudan and like Zimbabwe, which have some very basic problems. But these African countries also have natural resources that China desires, and so there's this quid pro quo, so to speak. And Russia, of course, is, you know, perhaps arguably the world's largest supplier of illicit arms, and that's, you know, a connection as well. And, of course, North Korea has trained some Zimbabwean soldiers and has a good relationship with Mugabe. So you can see it's a connection.
Absolutely. Professor Keller, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Edmund Keller is a professor of political science and the director of the Globalization Research Center on Africa at UCLA. He was with me at our NPR West studios. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. Iraqi forces and Shiite militiamen are clashing today in Basra, less than a week after the Iraq War entered its sixth year. The president says America is on the path to winning the war, but this week, the death toll for U.S. soldiers in Iraq reached 4,000. Troop drawdowns are planned through the end of the year, but can the U.S. fight two wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and deal with recruiting troubles and maintain its structural integrity? Delbert Spurlock thinks the troops are paying for decisions made by political leaders. He helped rebuild the Army under President Reagan as the Assistant Secretary of the Army for Manpower and Reserve Affairs. Today, he says the way troops are selected and prepared for service shows the U.S. Army is broken.
Most importantly, it can no longer recruit and retain the caliber of young men and women who are necessary to carry out the functions which the Army is compelled by our policymakers to deal with. The Army itself really is not large enough to take care of the missions integral even to the war in Iraq. We have been forced in this conflict to rely on contract mercenaries, the black waters of the world. But our Army for a century or more has been, when whole, a moral force for good. It's a deterrent force, and now it has lost the moral authority gained over a century.
Let's talk a little bit about specifics. The Army was meeting its recruiting goals, but that's partly because it's bending the rules a bit, allowing in more soldiers with criminal records, more soldiers without high school diplomas, some evidence that even some new recruits are gang members. And how does that affect not just the war right now and the Army's ability to fight it, but the long-term strength of the Army?
When the young people who come in are not capable of meeting the standards and engaging in the kind of training that is required, it slows down the process and makes us less capable when those young soldiers are put into combat without given the adequate amount of training. Right now, what we're faced with is pushing these young people into combat before they've had the opportunity to undergo the training, the remediation, the confidence building, the unit cohesion, which existed 20 years ago.
When you look ahead at the options that the U.S. has in terms of what you call the war of choice, Iraq specifically, what kinds of timetables should be put around a withdrawal? Should any timetables be put around a withdrawal? I'm not talking about what's politically possible. I'm talking about if you were the sole person in charge of making that decision, what would you say should unfold?
Well, if we come to some firm conclusions about how we are going to use our military based upon our national interests, we can begin to address the whole panoply of issues concerning the Middle East, South and Central America, Africa, and Muslim fundamentalism, for instance. But we're not going to be able to do that if we deal with issues in a piecemeal way. And we're not going to be able to do it if we do not engage the American people. We've been involved in these last 5 years in prosecuting a vicarious imperial war.
Delbert, I want to ask you to summarize your thoughts in one specific area, which is the interrelation between the American people, the idea of a public trust, and how this war will unfold and eventually come to an end. What role do you think American citizens should have in terms of communicating with the government, whether they're families of military members, friends of military members, or people who don't know anyone who's serving? What's the dialogue that needs to occur between the American people and the American government so that we can make smart decisions about how to deal with this war?
We've got to engage the American people in the whole panoply of issues concerning governance. And if we engage the American people in the kind of thing that I'm thinking about, I'm talking about, the Department of Defense will be at the center of that discussion. and we'll be engaged in the consequences of our acts. We will not be engaged in vicarious war. And I think our young people will start to return to the view that the United States Army and the all-volunteer force is a place to be without having to have enlistment bonuses into the $40,000 and $50,000 range.
Well, Delbert, thank you so much.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Delbert Spurlock served as Assistant Secretary of the Army for Manpower and Reserves Affairs from 1983 to 1988. Now to a true rags-to-riches story. Tasha Smith grew up poor in Camden, New Jersey. She and her twin sister were raised by their mother, who struggled with a drug addiction. Then Tasha started using drugs and hanging out with the wrong crowd. At 18, she moved to Los Angeles to start over. She worked her way up the ranks of stand-up comedy, and now she's making a name for herself in Hollywood. If you don't know her face, you probably know her voice. Here she is starring in Tyler Perry's film Why Did I Get Married as the boozy tell-it-like-it-is Angela.
I'm sick of dealing with your ghetto baby mama.
Do you mind?
Excuse us.
And what the hell are you talking about, do you mind? Y'all ain't never seen black people on a train? You ain't never heard of the Underground Railroad?
It's like we got a ghetto Harriet Tubman.
Ooh, let my people go. You heard me?
Snap.
She's drunk.
Yeah, we can tell.
Probably a 40.
Malt liquor.
Mm. You always have to embarrass me.
Look at you, Marcus. You are an embarrassment, okay?
Could you lay off of that for a while?
Could you go to hell for a while?
Already there.
Tasha, it's great to meet you.
Thank you.
So people can't see you, but you look fabulous and glamorous, and you look calm, unlike your character in the last Tyler Perry movie. I'm sure people must come up to you and say, you're a lot nicer in real life.
They do. Like, that's my alter ego. Mm-hmm. Angela was my, you know, I think every woman has an Angela on the inside of them that they would love to let out if they could. And if there were no repercussions. Okay.
Right.
So I have fun playing Angela.
What did you like about her?
I loved how open and forward and aggressive and tough and fearless Angela was. I loved how she said everything that everyone was thinking. And I mean, she's a strong, wonderful, full of life, full of energy black woman.
We got a chance to talk to Janet Jackson and Tyler Perry while they were promoting the film, and they both said how much they loved working as an ensemble. What was it like working together with that cast? So many great people.
Can I tell you that they spoiled me? I don't know if you saw The Corner. I'm going to digress a little. But when I had done The Corner and while we were researching the characters, every time we talked to a person that was addicted to heroin, they said it's always, you know, they're always trying to go back to get the first hit. That's how I feel about Why Did I Get Married? I feel like every job I've had, I'm always trying to get the first hit of Why Did I Get Married? Because the cast was so amazing.
You bring up a drug metaphor out of one of your roles, but you also started out on a pretty rocky path. Mm-hmm. You didn't come into acting out of, you know, X, Y, and Z after school program and a silver spoon in your mouth.
No.
Tell us a little bit about some of the challenges that you faced growing up.
Although I did do drugs growing up, but I guess every person that does drugs has that same, they ask me to go to rehab and you say no, no, no mentality. Or you act as if you got high, but you weren't as bad as a crackhead or you weren't as bad as a heroin addict, but, you know, you smoke weed every day and sniff cocaine every day, but I'm not really a drug addict like they were, you know. It's the same thing, really, at the end of the day. Although I can't necessarily recall the feeling of, I got to get back to the first hit, you know. It wasn't that experience for me. Grew up in a very rough neighborhood, you know, drugs, alcohol, prostitution, you know what I'm saying? Just that urban ghetto, I got to make money however I can lifestyle. And it is a blessing that I've gotten a new opportunity in life to be restored, to be able to become something positive, to be able to have a platform, to be an influence to other people that may be living in that environment right now, that I could come in and encourage and inspire them to know no matter what your current circumstances are, they will change if you have a dream.
How does acting bring out different phases of the human experience?
Wow, I got to tell you, like, acting changed my life. I say God and then acting. Because becoming an actor, I've gained a new respect for humanity. And I believe that it's also helped me to grow as a person. It's been one of the biggest blessings and expressions that I could have ever been gifted with.
I want to talk about what you do with actors. You've got the Tasha Smith Actors Workshop. Tell us about the techniques you use, who you work with. Why do you like teaching?
My teacher, who is Ivana Chubbuck, who has been my teacher and mentor, she took a lot of time to really lay some wonderful foundation and technique in how I approach my work. And in going through that process, I've learned how to confront my life and how to not necessarily suppress everything that I've experienced, but just use it and look at it as an experience that will allow me to be able to identify with something within every character. So what we try to do in TESOL, which is Tasha Smith Actors Workshop, is to help the actor get to the core of who they really are and how they really feel. So we may have them do a dump where you just basically express everything that you feel like you have not been able to express, whether it's good, bad, or ugly. The freedom that we can get through the art of acting is priceless. And I just enjoy helping people get there. I enjoy encouraging and inspiring people to pursue their purpose in the arts, to help cultivate and develop their instrument, and to know I had a part with helping someone change their life. Because if they cultivate their instrument and allow themselves to be developed, guess what? Their life is going to change because they're going to get success.
Where I'd love to leave it is, your family had such hard times in the past, and now, in addition to your personal success, it sounds like everyone has been lifted up. Tell me a little bit about how your family's doing.
My family is doing great. My mom, first of all, is on her 20th year clean. She is a sponsor to many people that are coming off of drugs, that are in the midst of their battles that she's overcome. She is the bomb. Okay, we're actually going to be working on some books together and doing a tour, a mother-daughter tour, to be able to empower people whose parents may have been addicted to drugs and the children who are dealing with their parents that have been addicted to drugs. My sisters are amazing. My sister is my business partner, my twin. She's an amazing producer, writer. You know, we're just grinding and trying to make my mother proud as well as God.
Tasha, it's been so great talking to you.
Thank you for your time.
Actress and acting instructor Tasha Smith. You can hear more about her acting career and how she found God on our website, nprnewsandnotes.org.